the incredibly breakable, foldable phone, wisdom graphs, stalkerware, and take off your AirPods when you talk to me. All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 79, recorded Thursday, April 18th, 2019. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CashFly. Give your users the seamless online experience they want. Power your site or your app with CashFly CDN, that's Content Delivery Network, and be 30% faster than the competition. Learn more at twit.cashfly.com. And by LinkedIn Talent Solutions. Find the right people for your business this year at linkedin.com/technews and get $50 off your first job post. And by Envoy. Envoy builds beautiful modern software to help businesses elevate the physical workplace experience. With Envoy visitors, you can greet guests with a welcoming, sleek iPad sign-in app while still protecting your people, your property, and your ideas. Start your free trial today at envoy.com/twit. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney. Jason Howell is on vacation this week, but the show must go on. As of this recording, Samsung is scheduled to release its new foldable Galaxy phone on April 26th, but some reviewers have had their hands on this device for a few days. One of those reporters is Mike Murphy from Quartz. Welcome back to the show, Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I shouldn't call you a reporter. You're an editor now. You're the tech editor. But you still report and you still tweet and you still have this phone. And unlike some other reviewers, your phone still works even after almost 4 days.
That's true. Yeah, it's been a full four days that I've had this phone and it still works, which is, you know, kind of what you would expect of most phones that have ever existed. But that hasn't been the case for a lot of other fold reviewers.
So before we get to that, how are you liking the phone?
I'm actually like in the process of still writing my review. But I think that, so on the outside, I don't know how well this shows up. The tiny screen on the outside is very silly. There we go. Nope, that's better. This bothers me a lot because this is theoretically how you're going to use it a lot when you're like on the subway or, you know, just pulling out of your pocket or something. Because you're not supposed to do this. See, it doesn't work. There we go.
You're not supposed to do that.
Yeah, you're not supposed to. Sorry. Hopefully Samsung isn't watching. like you're supposed to sit there and open it like it's a book. So it's just awkward in a lot of situations where I find myself using the phone because of how we're conditioned to use phones with one hand. And Samsung said the reason this screen is so tiny is because you're supposed to be able to use it with one hand. But it's like, I can do that with this pretty much and it doesn't look weird. So I don't know. But when it comes to the inside, and mine hasn't broken yet, I think it's a really neat idea that isn't quite ready for anyone at any price. Like, this is slightly better than a prototype. It's a thing you can buy, and it does lots of nice Samsung-related things, but I'm really afraid I'm going to break it just by using it. And I thought that before all the stuff yesterday. You know, it just feels... You know, it doesn't close flush. It closes at a little angle. I just felt like I was going to break it. So it's a weird one, to be honest.
Well, it's weird because, like, you know, we've already been told that you're not supposed to take that polymer lining off. And we'll talk about that. But also, like, that other I haven't even heard the other thing. You're not supposed to open it like you would normally open it. There's, like, a lot of not supposed to do for a $2,000 phone.
Yeah, exactly. You're also not supposed to put it in your back pocket. That was a question that was asked by another reporter when we got them. It's like, oh, I put my phone in my back pocket a lot. And one of the people from Samsung was like, yeah, probably wouldn't do that. And again, it's like, it's not fragile, but it's a bendable piece of material. And it's like, you know how much wear and tear your phone goes through anyway. And on top of that, you're adding in a thing that bends, and it's like they've only rated it for 200,000 bends, which seems like a lot. That's about 300 a day for 2 years, but I mean, I know I'm probably getting at least that many now, and who knows if it'll actually hit that many. You know, they're saying it's rated for that, and then four of them have already broken. I don't know how many are out there in the world, but not many. They're not on sale yet.
Yeah, and so have you heard that they're going to not actually release them on April 26th, or as far as you know, that's still the date?
Samsung told me last night that they still plan to release on the 26th. Mm.
Okay, so let's talk about that polymer layer. It looks like a little bit like, to some people, to Mark Gurman at Bloomberg, it looked like a screen protector, and he peeled it right off. I've seen some tweets about, you know, a little warning that says, do not remove this, but that's apparently not on any review units. So, yeah, if you're watching the video, you can see that. That wasn't on your review unit, was it?
No, I think the person who tweeted that works at T-Mobile, so maybe that'll be on T-Mobile's ones because they're one of the companies that's going to have them. But the review unit I got just came in this kind of piece of plastic with it had just black on the front of it. There was nothing else. That being said, and I said this to you before, it's like, yeah, I guess if you look closely, it kind of looks like a screen protector, but like I had just taken off a piece of plastic, so I didn't feel like I was going to be taking off another piece of plastic. And honestly, I didn't even notice it until I got an email from Samsung saying, hey, don't take that thing off. And then I actually still tried to, you know, I stick my finger in there. I'm like doing it right now. And it's not easy. I have no nails, so that doesn't help. But like, it's also not easy. I feel like I would have gotten halfway through this and gone, I've done something I wasn't supposed to do. Not to like, you know, diss anyone else who has a unit, but it just seems like it wasn't meant to be that. I don't know. That was my impression anyway.
Right. And then Marques Brownlee, I guess he did it too, right in front of the Samsung person who was like, whoa, don't do that. And then gave him a different one. So I guess he got lucky. But then The Verge there. Yeah, there's Marques's. But The Verge, they did not take the Dieterbone did not take his plastic covering off. He just got something in the fold and then that made the screen break.
Yeah, it wasn't entirely clear what exactly happened, but they did suggest that there was something that gotten in, like, I would guess up here where the kind of edge around the screen breaks. There's a lip on the whole device apart from where it folds. So maybe something got in there. But then CNBC's phone also started just completely crashing out. And so Dieter's might have happened because there was something that got under, and, you know, with any, you know, kind of soft surface, you're going to be able to pierce it. But like, I can imagine it'd be pretty easy even if I just press super hard. But that's the same, like, if there was no glass on this, that would be the same. So I get that. But, you know, CNBC's, they didn't do anything as far as we know. It just stopped working. And I keep being afraid every time I'm going to open it that the screen will go black, and I don't know why.
Yeah, not what you want in your device that holds everything and is your one way of communicating and, of course, tweeting, which is important. And so, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, it's only two, it's only three, it's only four, whatever it is. But you review a lot of phones. Has anything ever, I mean, you besides just phones, has anything like this ever happened where, you know, so like such a large percentage of the people who have them, they break right away?
Not in the years that I have been doing this that I can think of something. I mean, I remember the iPhone 4, I believe it was the 4, not the 4S, that had the reception issue because of the material that was coating the outside metal. But that was, what, 8 years ago, 9 years ago? When it comes to, like, most standard tech products these days, I haven't seen anything like this. And the only time I've honestly seen any kind of recall or any calls for anything like that was the Samsung Galaxy Note 7, which, you know, literally exploded for like 90 people. You know, this isn't quite that bad in terms of like damage, but, you know, if we're seeing this fail rate on these devices with such a few, with so few in the market, yeah, then maybe there is a real issue here. I can't think of anything similar. The only thing I can think in this particular case is that maybe the common thread is that there was a bad run with these devices that just out of pure chance, everyone got from, you know, it was the same line of failures for every single one of these devices, and every other device would be fine. There are always there are always devices, even on something like an iPhone 8, which has been produced at that design for years, there are always ones that have failures. There are always ones that just, you know, random bugs happen. But it does seem quite weird that so many happened in such a short period of time.
Yeah. And I mean, it strikes me as the problem I see a lot of times with like Internet of Things devices. I know you've had your own struggle with smart plugs, where it's like the problem that you're solving has to be bigger than the problems the technology itself creates. So there's still a question of like, why do we really even need a folding phone? And if I'm going to have to pay $2,000 for it and it's not going to work, what's the point?
I think that's totally true. And yeah, I have had some serious issues with Wi-Fi plugs in the past, and definitely had people going, why don't you just walk over and press the switch like a normal person? Which is a great question. And it's similar to this. It's like, why are you spending $2,000 on a phone that's worse at being your phone than the phone you have? Like the Samsung Galaxy S10 Plus that came out a little over a month ago is a phenomenal phone, and it's giant. So if you're looking for a big ass screen that you can put in your pocket, it probably won't die in 4 days. That's a great phone. Samsung's rationale, and I kind of get it, is that, at least for this device in particular, rather than folding phones, is like, well, we wanted to get it out. And this is for the same kind of person that wanted to buy something like, well, they didn't say this, but like something like Google Glass. Like, they thought that they were going to be part of the future and they had the money to be in early. I don't think that's a very big market. I think Samsung sees this as a kind of luxury product, a kind of aspirational thing. But when it comes to folding phones in general, I don't think we're there yet. But I do think having something that takes up, you know, this is super thick, but having something that takes up this much less space in your pocket, and you can kind of pull out to an even bigger screen maybe in the future, that's super cool. I mean, I think that just being able to kind of have a thing that could theoretically unfold to like the size of a real tablet or a laptop in your pocket, that's awesome. And then you're replacing every device and you only have one. That's great. This is not that. This is a phone that's bent in half.
Well, Mike, as you said in your piece, we'll have to see how this story unfolds.
Oh, yeah.
Mike Murphy is the tech editor at Quartz. You can find his work at QZ.com, or he is MCWM on Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Bye.
Life, it's challenging and messy. What if instead of putting a rosy filter on your particular mess, you could use an app to connect to someone who's been there and can help? We'll talk to the founder of an app that is doing just that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Cashfly. Give your users the seamless online experience that they want. Power your site or your app with Cashfly CDN and be 30% faster than the competition. No matter what industry your business is in, if your website is directly tied to company revenue, you can give your customers the fast downloads they need with Cashfly. Cashfly CDN delivers rich media content up to 10 times faster than traditional delivery methods, and up to 30% faster than other major CDNs. Backed by a 100% SLA, Cashfly guarantees the best user experience for all your customers, no matter where they are or what device they're on. Join the thousands of others who trust Cashfly's reliable network, including LG, Microsoft, Adobe, and Ars Technica. We have been hosting all of our podcasts, audio and video, on Cashfly for nearly a decade. Every month, our viewers, you, I'm talking to you, and our listeners, also you, download petabytes of data fast and flawlessly. And Leo will tell you that Twit would not exist without Cashfly. Say goodbye to logging in multiple times a week, or worse, every day, trying to track your CDN usage. No billing spikes. You get a custom plan tailored to your CDN needs based on yearly usage trends. On average, customers who switch to Cashfly save more than 20%. Just imagine what you could do with that 20%. And your time. And just for you Twit listeners, Cashfly is giving away a complimentary detailed analysis of your current CDN bill and your usage trends. See if you're overpaying 20% or more for CDN. Learn more at twit.cashfly.com. That's twit.cashfly.com. And we thank Cashfly for their support. More and more of us are turning away from Facebook and turning toward other places, online and offline, for connection. But where do you go? We are going to talk to Boaz Gan, the founder and CEO of Wisdo, an app that connects people seeking help with people who want to offer help in the areas of physical health, mental health, self-growth, sexuality, identity, and family. Welcome to the show, Boaz.
Thank you so much, Megan. Thanks so much for having me.
So
it's
first,
an honor.
Well, thank you. Tell us why you decided to create Wisdo.
So Wisdo is, like you said, self-care platform that helps people take on life's meaningful experiences by relying on the wisdom of people who've been there. Like many people watching your show, I went through a personal experience that taught me the value of leaning on people who've been there. In my case, it was taking care of my dad who was ill with a serious illness. And the contradiction that I'm sure many of people watching this have experienced between, on the one hand, going through something that you know millions have gone through before, and at the same time feeling completely alone and uncertain about what tomorrow will bring, I found that contradiction difficult to bear, and I set out to find something that would solve this problem.
It's great because, I mean, I have teenagers and I have a friend that a work colleague who just had a baby. And it's like, well, I don't really remember what it's like to have a newborn baby. But, you know, I'm sure there are people out there that could say, you know what, it's whatever you're experiencing. I experienced it 2 months ago or 3 months ago. And, it, you know, I've been there. So it's great to be able to find an app that can help you quickly connect to people. So how does the app itself work?
Yeah, so I don't know if you're familiar with Waze, the navigation app. It basically, you know, functions in the same way. So we crowdsource all of life's journeys into steps and timelines, or the metaphor would be junctions. So people come in and suggest what they believe are the major steps or milestones along any significant life experience. That's the first thing that we do. We're talking about thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of data points. The second thing that we do is that when people join us, we say to them, you know, hey guys, tell us what you've been through so we can connect you to people who've been there. And they choose one experience. Like you said, it can be parenting, it can be building a home, it can be anxiety, it can be depression, it can be increasing happiness. And then, you know, what happens, which is something pretty cool, I think, what pops up are all the steps that other people have suggested because they've been there. And then they go, been there, been there, been there. Just click through that and help us learn specifically from that list what they've been through. And then the third step is really matching them with people who've been there, either on a one-on-one basis, what we call a buddy program. So we're going to introduce you to someone with whom, imagine, you share 200 steps. 400 steps. You're going to meet someone that you don't know. He's not your friend. He's not a friend of a friend. He's not part of your social graph at all. But it's someone that has walked in your shoes and will get you, you know, in a millisecond because he's been there. So that's one option. And the other option is to land in a group comprised of people who have been through similar experiences. And starting to chat with those guys and I'm looking for the support that you need. And then what is, I think, pretty unique about Wisdo, and you know, you referred to other social, you know, networks out there. I think many of them have, you know, prioritized popularity. So the people who are ranked highest are the people who have, you know, the greatest number of friends or have written, you know, the stuff that has been liked by quite a few folks because it's provocative or, you know, extremely, you know, unique. We try to prioritize and promote helpfulness. So we remove the like button. We have a helpful button. We count those and we count other criteria that we measure. And then we promote helpful people. So the more you help other people, the higher you're going to be ranked on the platform. You're going to come in as a user. You're going to become a helper. You're going to become a guide. You're going to become a super guide. And everyone is going to know it. And the more you help other people, you know, those positive reviews are going to be published on your profile. You're going to be able to flaunt them and be really proud of helping others through stuff that you've gone through because life teaches us lessons and these lessons are worth passing over.
I love your comparison to Waze because I just, when I use Waze, I do feel comforted. It's like someone's like, oh, there's roadkill on the road up ahead, you know, and it's like, what is that person's, what are they gaining from, you know, adding that, spending time adding that, you know, and it's just like nothing. And it's just like people who want to help each other And it's one thing to help each other on, you know, the 405 freeway in LA, and it's totally other thing to want to help people who've been going through stuff. I mean, there's so I listed the top level categories, but there's so many individual. I mean, there's people transitioning genders, and you know, just so much stuff. Talk a little bit about what are the areas that you find people the most people are flocking to.
So this is really interesting. You know, just like sort of, you know, the maps on Waze are a reflection of, you know, the way people are driving in a specific terrain or in a specific geography. The various verticals and experiences on Wisdo are a reflection of the user base. So since we went live about 14, 15 months ago, through about, you know, a million downloads, the demographic that has been, you know, connecting with Wisdo are the 18 to 34, you know, the 18 to 34 age group. And it's been really interesting to see how the experiences that they travel through, so to speak, are, you know, a reflection of what that age group is, you know, going through in life. So I would divide it into three major buckets. One is mental health, which we were surprised by. I don't know what's going on with, you know, people in this age group, but, you know, they're not as socially supported as you would think, even though they've grown up on social. And maybe that's the reason that they're so, you know, socially disconnected. So mental health would be things like anxiety, depression, loneliness, heartbreak, PTSD, etc. The second big bucket would be the flip side of that. So self-improvement experiences that would take you from a place where you're down to a place where you feel, you know, happier, more socially supported, more resilient. So you would find things like increasing happiness, reducing stress, improving sleep, you know, getting motivated, body image, et cetera, and then the third would be relationships. So falling in love, getting married, you know, adopting a child, anything that has to do with, you know, meaningful relationship with other people. I think, you know, just from a social perspective, I think the fascinating thing that we've seen is that across verticals, across experiences, if there's one thing that has, you know, proven to be the antidote for feeling disconnected, that would be helping other people. And I think that's pretty beautiful and powerful. We see people becoming happier by helping others. Even though they came into Wisdo looking for help, they find the help they need by helping others and pushing them sort of, you know, up the road, up the mountain. And then you see them, you know, a month or two into using the platform, they feel happier, more resilient, more connected, you know, and it's a little ray of hope in the online universe.
So I signed up with my first and last name, and you have a lot of choices. You could sign up through Facebook or Google. I chose with my phone number. Is there, and so I was a little bit surprised right when I, you know, got into the groups that everybody's first and last name is there. Is there a place for anonymity there, or is just that not really what this is about?
No, absolutely. You can log in through any username that you would invent. You can, you know, go into your profile, change the username. Many people do, you know, they invent all sorts of names that make them feel comfortable. They don't have to upload their photo. We do, you know, need to know what is the sort of, you know, email or phone number that you use in order to sign in onto the platform, even though that wouldn't be available or visible to anyone else on the platform, nor we would, you know, obviously sell it for commercial purposes. We don't do that. The only reason that we do ask for some sort of identification is because we want to protect the trust and safety of the people on the platform. So if you will be misbehave, and I'm sure that you won't, but, you know, some people do, unfortunately. We want to be able to warn them, and then we want to be able to suspend them. And then if they, you know, misbehave again, we want to be able to ban them. And we want to be able to do that in a way that they won't be able to, you know, sign in again with another phone or, you know, with another device. So, you know, we do that with trust and safety of people in mind. We also, and that's a strategic decision that we've made, I think, with trust and safety in mind, we're a platform for people 17 and older. You know, there was a pattern of very young folks, 9 years old, 11 years old, 13 years old, going into you know, pretty intense groups. As you go into ISDO, you need to confirm that you're 17 and older. And if we find out that you're not, then we would ask you to leave, which again is the reason that we ask for some sort of identification as you sign in.
I love that it's 17 and older, because I just felt like once my kids turned 13, it's like everything is just 13. Most things are just 13 and older. And that's just because of the COPPA, the Children Online Privacy Act, which doesn't really, I mean, that's the law, but that's not maybe when kids are ready to sign up for all these services without parental consent. So I love that part of it. I know you've raised a significant amount of seed funding. Is that the way that, the app is supported?
So, yeah, I mean, we've been around for a while. So, you know, the funding that we raised 3+ years ago is something that's sustained us to date. We're, you know, in the midst of raising some more money now. We have started to think about monetization and even more than think about, you know, actually testing stuff that, you know, users would find valuable and, you know, interesting and won't contradict the, you know, the core value that the platform seems to be creating, which is connecting people through similar experiences. And that seems to be working really strongly, and we've just put it on the platform, and I personally love it, is this concept of a five-step program, what we call the hand-in-hand program. So one of the interesting, you know, things about WISDO is the data play. We know, based on millions of data points, what are the five most, you know, important or must-know steps for any life experience. So we know what the five most important steps in motherhood are based on people who, you know, based on moms. We know what are the five most important steps in depression or anxiety or, you know, building your self-esteem based on many people who've been through that. So what we've done is we've identified those five steps based on the, you know, been there clicks that people submit. And then we attach timeline guides who are able to walk you through those five steps to ensure that, you know, you come out of this in a better way. We've played around also, you would pay that guide, you know, for now, $10 or $15 a month. So he or she would guide you through this, you know, structured program. And then you can look at other programs and, you know, get them at a discount, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the metaphor here is, and, you know, I just came back from that. Someone gave it to me and I really liked it. It's like a gym. You know, you go into a gym, there's a ton of people there. Everyone is doing their thing. Everyone is talking to, you know, all sorts of people. But then if you really want to make progress, a trainer is going to, you know, approach you and say, all right, so, you know, let's create a program. Let's create a 5-step or a 10, you know, appointment program after which you're going to be better at something. Either, you know, your cardio is going to be better. Your legs are going to be stronger, you know, whatever your goal is, achieve it. But it's a structured program based on know-how that has been earned in that place. So that's what we're doing. We currently have about 10 to 15 programs. We have hundreds of certified guides who are guiding folks through, you know, meaningful life events. And it's the best of all worlds because A, people feel better. B, the guides are being rewarded. C, you know, we don't have to bombard the platform with, you know, just blind, you know, mind-numbing ads. And it seems to be working.
So I know there's a lot of talk about algorithms these days, like, and how they can go terribly, terribly wrong. But I mean, but I know Google and Facebook is sort of good at this. Like, if you type in, like, I'm about to commit suicide, you know, mm-hmm. The algorithm will find, you know, if you do that into Google, it'll show you the suicide prevention line. Is there anything like that involved in WISDO, like any sort of emergency procedures that are put in through technology or through people?
Yep. So what we did is basically, you know, follow Wikipedia, which I think is one of the, has proven to be one of the safer platforms online, in a combination of tech and moderators. Seems that that combination of sort of cyborgs, as I call them, not bots, but cyborgs, combination of, you know, tech and humans, has proven to be again and again, if it's Wikipedia or Waze, et cetera, the most effective way to ensure a safe platform. So what we did is, on the one hand, we have, you know, watch lists that have, you know, words and combination of words that would trigger a notification. And those notifications are going to be sent to moderators on the platform, you know, the guides, the helpers, et cetera, that would be able to go into that specific instance, look at it, make all whether it's safe or not. And then they have, you know, ready-made texts and, you know, other sort of, you know, tech-assisted solutions that would better that enable them to intervene. That's how it works. And it's been working really, really well. I have, you know, it might be worth noting that almost 11% of our users do become moderators. So this is a very high engagement platform. And they, or the top pyramid of that platform, gets to control the watch list. So they actually have the ability to edit and add both words and combination of words that they have seen consistently causing concern, and be users who you know, become sort of repeated offenders. So if you came into the platform, you know, misbehaved, you bothered people, you offended people, you trolled others, then one of the super is going to in all probability add you to a watch list. And then every time you do that, you know, a red flag is going to go up and someone is going to go in and, you know, see what's up with you. So, you know, just to sum up, the combination of tech and a highly engaged moderated community seems to create a safer platform, at least for us.
And what about information sharing? What part of, like, are the communities private? Are the, what's the privacy in the one-to-one chats? What can you tell us about that?
So, you know, the platform is really a combination of public and private. The public being the groups, and the private being the one-on-ones. The way, you know, what we're seeing in terms of user journeys, that the groups are sort of the discovery opportunity. You know, users go into them in discovery mode. They come in, either they just joined or they, you know, want to just update themselves on the latest group, you know, see what's new, and, you know, look at new people that joined. And then once they identify someone with whom they want to have a deeper conversation, a more intimate conversation, or, you know, we suggest to a specific person, you know, here's someone that we think you should speak to. You know, that's, I think, another part of what we call the wisdom graph. You know, Google has their knowledge graph, Facebook has their social graph. We think we're building the wisdom graph because we can tell you, here's someone that you don't know that we think you can have a meaningful conversation with based on some sort of similarity in your life experiences. And then we sort of, you know, encourage you to have a one-on-one with that specific person. Obviously, all one-on-ones, they're completely private. We don't know what's going on there, you know, and we should know what's going on there in terms of, you know, the content that is being shared. You know, we do know when a conversation is especially long, or it turns out to be, you know, specifically meaningful, where, for example, a buddy is, you know, would be highly rated by the helper. It's important for us to look at those, you know, data points to try and optimize and encourage more meaningful conversations, but we don't know what the content is. In the public groups, the content is public. So everyone can read it. Obviously, again, you can be in the group under any name at all. What we're seeing users doing is saving the more public conversations to the groups. And then when they want to have a deeper, you know, more intimate conversation, they start a one-on-one with a specific user.
Boaz, thank you so much. Boaz Gohn is the founder and CEO of Wisdo. You can download the Android or the iOS app in the respective app stores, and you can learn more at wisdo.com. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you so much, and thank you for supporting mission-driven companies.
All right. Take care. Good luck with everything.
All the best. Bye-bye.
After the break, Eva Galperin from the Electronic Frontier Foundation is here to talk about her fight against stalkerware. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LinkedIn Talent Solutions. When it's time to make a hire for your small business, naturally, you want to find the best person for the job. Odds are that that person is hiding right there in plain sight on LinkedIn. LinkedIn Jobs makes it easy to get matched with quality candidates who make the most sense for your role. LinkedIn Jobs uses knowledge of both hard skills and soft skills to match you with the people who fit your role best. People come to LinkedIn every day to learn and advance their careers, so LinkedIn understands what they're interested in and what they're looking for, which means when you use LinkedIn Jobs to hire someone, your matches are based on so much more than a resume. Your LinkedIn Jobs matches are based on skills and background, sure, but also interests, activities, and passions. Matching lets you quickly get a group of the most relevant qualified candidates for your role. That way you can focus on the candidates that you want to spend time talking to and make a quality hire that you're excited about. Customers rank LinkedIn Jobs number one in delivering quality hires. Post a job today at linkedin.com/technews and get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/technews to get $50 off your first job post. linkedin.com/technews. Terms and conditions apply. Stalkerware, sometimes called spouseware, is software that abusers install on their targets' phones and laptops to track and torment them and steal photos, sometimes used as blackmail. Many security breachers have neglected to call this kind of behavior hacking because it requires physical access to the target's device. Eva Galperin, head of cybersecurity for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, has been raising the alarm about stalkerware and is here to talk about what else she's been doing. Welcome to the show, Eva.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So at the EFF, you've been a digital rights activist reporting on Syrian malware. You fought against SOPA and PIPA. How does this lead you to be such a huge advocate against stalkerware?
Well, part of what I do at EFF's Threat Lab, which I run, is we have a sort of concentration on protecting vulnerable populations. So I started by spending a lot of time protecting journalists and activists from online threats, specifically threats by governments and law enforcement. And it became very clear to me over the years that we needed to have sort of a broader view of what constitutes a vulnerable population. And this includes women and LGBTQ populations and people who are in domestic abuse situations. And very often the kind of malware that I see on their devices is this stalkerware, which you can install if you have physical access to the device, but which is often installed also with the username and password. And a lot of AV companies refused for a long time to consider this to be malware, because they assumed that if you have the username and password for an account, that you have legitimate access to the account. And so I had to sit them down and say, I don't think you understand how abuse works. So that's one of the things that I'm trying to change right now.
So you sent out a tweet basically looking for people that might be experiencing this kind of abuse. And what was the response?
Well, specifically, what happened was I did many years of security research on nation state malware, and it turned out that one of the people that I had spent all of my time doing research with was a serial rapist. And in 2018, an article came out with an interview with one of his victims, and the victim said that the reason she had not reported him for many years was because she was really scared. And she was scared that he would hack her devices, and he had threatened to do so. So I became furious, and I did what all angry people do on the internet. I tweeted. And what I tweeted was that if you're a woman who's been sexually abused by a hacker who threatened to compromise her devices, you could come and contact me, and I would make sure they got a proper examination.
And so it looks like it's been retweeted almost 10,000 times. So you then began to work directly with these women.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I spent about a year and a half working directly with, and to be clear, not just women. I want to be clear that abuse is not just something that men do to women. I saw women abusing men. I talked to people who were in same-sex relationships with abuse. But the overwhelming majority of them were women who came to me, and the overwhelming majority of abusers were men.
So you were recently profiled in Wired, and just they wrote about just how much time this was taking and how you eventually realized that although you are a superhero, you could not solve this problem. You didn't realize you were a superhero. I realized that after reading this, but that you couldn't do it on your own. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing now.
All right. So I started receiving a lot of messages. I was receiving somewhere between, you know, zero and like 20 or 30 messages a day. And I was, you know, I saw a real cross section of the population. So I saw people who were being scammed, who weren't really in danger, people who had their accounts compromised, and I saw people who had their devices compromised. And device compromise was definitely not the most common problem that I saw, but it was also associated with the worst abuses that I saw. Now, when people have their accounts compromised, there's advice that I can already give them. I can tell people with compromised accounts, change all your passwords, use a password manager, use strong and unique passwords, and use the strongest method of two-factor authentication that you're comfortable with. And that will take care of like 99% of the problems that I see. But if people have spouseware or stalkerware installed on their devices, if their devices have been compromised, I didn't have a lot of advice that I could give them aside from, you know, send me your device so that I can get it a forensic examination. And that takes a lot of time. And so one of the things that I did was I went around and I looked at whether or not there were any AV companies that were currently marking this stuff as malicious. And it turned out almost no one. It turned out that that was extremely rare behavior. And one of the reasons for that was, as I said before, that antivirus companies consider some of the uses of these products to be legitimate, and therefore marking them as malicious would be bad. So I went to a bunch of companies and I talked to them about what I wanted them to do. And the first company that I got on board was Kaspersky. So a couple weeks ago, Kaspersky announced that they were going to start taking spouseware and stalkerware seriously, and they were going to start marking it as malicious when they found it. And that's a really big step forward. And interestingly enough, about a week later, Lookout followed up with a blog post in which they said, we have always taken this stuff seriously, and you can also install Lookout if you if you're worried that you have one of these malicious programs on your device. So now there are options. So we've got two companies on board, and I'm calling on all the other AV companies to join the club.
So are you mostly talking about cell phones, like Android phones?
I'm talking about tablets. I mean, also, I definitely saw people with compromised you know, laptops and PCs. But by far, the most abusive form of compromise is compromising somebody's phone, because you keep so much important information about your life on your phone. Because your location is constantly being reported, because all of your text messages and your phone calls and your photos are all located on your phone. Your list of contacts is on your phone. You log into all of your social media accounts from your phone. And so access to your phone is very much like access to your mind. And that's incredibly invasive. And I wanted to be able to do something about that.
So you said most of the, I mean, it's much easier to get this kind of spouseware installed on an Android phone, but it's not impossible to do it on an iPhone. And you've suggested some changes that Apple could also make to make this clearer to people who might have spouseware on their phones.
Yes. So right now, if you want to install this kind of spouseware on an iPhone, you need to be running a fairly outdated version of the operating system, because usually these phones need to be jailbroken first. So I think the last available public untethered jailbreak is from iOS 9 point something. But there are other things that these products do. First of all, I would like Apple to take a look at whether or not they can make it impossible to covertly jailbreak a phone. which would do a lot for taking care of this one particular vector. And it's not entirely clear that it's possible, because you get into the problem of, you know, can God build or can God create a rock so heavy he can't lift it? Once you've jailbroken the phone, you have root on the phone, you can make it do anything you want. Making changes that you can't change with that kind of access may not be possible. But I'd like them to give it a try. Additionally, the other vector that these products use in order to install themselves on iPhones is they pull iCloud backups. So I'm going to be having a chat with Apple about how to better protect iCloud backups, even if somebody already has access to the to somebody's Apple ID.
And you said even apps that are built into the phone, like Find My Friends, people can use that as a form of abuse.
Yes, people use Find My Phone, people use Find My Friends. The good news about that stuff is that it's transparent. Mm-hmm. So you know when somebody has added your device to their, has added their device to your Apple ID, and you can go check that. And if there's another device there that doesn't belong there, you can kick it off, which is something that you cannot currently do with stalkerware or spouseware. So I decided that I would start with the stuff that has no immediate signs and try to create some immediate signs that people can look for.
I mean, I've looked at a ton of different apps, you know, I have three teenagers, so, you know, they're just the kind of make sure, the net nanny type things. I don't use any of them. They could see their way around all of them, and I realized I don't want them to grow up with Big Brother anyway. But I could see, I mean, have you seen that that partners might use those tools? Because you can, I mean, even on iOS, there are iOS apps that will give you a lot of access to iPhones without necessarily... if you had access to that phone to install it, you wouldn't necessarily know.
Oh, absolutely. And for me, the difference between these sort of parental monitoring apps and spouseware and stalkerware is transparency. Mm-hmm. Transparency and consent. So if the app is designed to run covertly without alerting the user of the device, I consider that to be stalkerware or spouseware, and it should be marked as malware, and you should be able to run antivirus, identify it, and remove it from your device. There are lots of parental tracking applications that do not run transparently, mm-hmm. that have an icon on your, you know, on your home screen that you can see, and you can see that the thing is running, and you can tell what it does. And while I don't always approve of those apps, I would not consider them to be spouseware or stalkerware, because you know that you're being watched. Mm-hmm.
And so now I've never used Lookout. I mean, I've heard of Lookout. I use it on my Android phone, but I never mm-hmm. use it on an iPhone. Is that something you recommend, like some kind of antivirus on an iPhone?
If you are concerned about spouseware or stalkerware on your phone right now, I would recommend probably using either Kaspersky or Lookout's products. And Lookout has AV for iOS, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's free. Eva, thank you so much for joining us. Eva Galperin is the Director of Cybersecurity at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. You should check out EFF's Threat Lab. They also have a whole kit with so much information, and you can also find her at EvaSide on Twitter. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
All right. Thank you so much.
Take care. Coming up, why you should always remember when you're wearing your AirPods. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Envoy. It's time to welcome guests to the modern lobby and be ready for everything that comes through your front door. Envoy Visitors is an iPad kiosk that makes workplace more efficient. How does Envoy Visitors work? When visitors arrive, they sign in on an iPad kiosk. In our case, we have this adorable little iPad mini at the front desk. Oh, it's not at the front desk right now because I wanted to show it to you. Here it is. It's got a little case. It's nice. And then when you come to visit us, which I hope you do, tickets at twit.tv, come visit us. You get to enter your details and you sign any legal documents like NDAs or whatever. And you do it right here on this iPad. We used to have to do this with paper, which always felt super wasteful. I do not know. Every person who came through the door had to sign a thing. And I don't think anyone ever looked at any of those papers. It was just a waste. Envoy helps with that, and they'll also notify the person that's expecting you. So that's another thing. If you had lots of emails with this person that's coming to your office, and all of a sudden you forget their name, Envoy will tell you. It's a secret thing. They know who's coming, and it makes those awkward meetings. You won't have those awkward meetings. I mean, if it's going to be awkward, you're going to make it awkward, not Envoy. Here are the benefits of using Envoy visitors. Boost your office efficiency with smart security that doesn't intimidate. There's no more paper logbook that doesn't provide any real value. Sign in unlimited visitors. So bring all your friends. Tickets at twit.tv. Bring them all. You can use customized badges. You can print customized badges from Envoy. You can send alerts when VIPs arrive. It even notifies administrators about unattended guests. You can integrate with your existing security systems like Wi-Fi access, ID checks, and emergency notifications, giving you advanced security. Finally, you'll have data on the visitors in your office, so you know who's coming, when they're on site, who they're meeting with, and why. Envoy Visitors works with the tools you already use, such as Slack, G Suite, Box, and Salesforce. Chatter, that's just a few of them. They're designed to help companies of all types, including those in highly regulated industries. They meet security and compliance requirements. Join companies like Nike, Pinterest, and Spotify. They've all worked with Envoy to welcome over 30 million visitors. Protect your people, your property, and your ideas the welcoming way with Envoy. See why 10,000 workplaces worldwide choose Envoy to make a great first impression. Go to envoy.com/twit to start your free trial today. That's envoy.com/twit. AirPods, they're making things awkward, not because they're weirdly shaped or because they don't fit in my ears, but because people are forgetting when they're wearing them, and that's making it difficult to communicate with them. Alex Kantrowitz is here to talk about what he's calling the AirPod barrier. Welcome back to the show, Alex.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
So I assume you're listening to me on those AirPods right now. Is that correct?
Can't really comment on that one way or the other.
So what is the AirPod barrier?
Well, one of the things I've noticed with the AirPods, and I'm certainly guilty of this as well, is people just kind of leave them in all the time. They're so small, you can't really feel them in your ear after a long time. And that makes things a little awkward between anyone wearing AirPods and anyone trying to interact with them, whether it's their barber or somebody serving them, or even the people they're in relationships with.
So we're showing your piece here, right? I believe that's Ryan mm-hmm. Mack of BuzzFeed. He's always wearing AirPods. Apparently, that's why he's not responding to my emails, I guess. Am I allowed, if I see someone like Ryan in a Blue Bottle coffee shop, am I allowed to walk up to him and smack those AirPods right out of his ears?
Well, it depends on the legal jurisdiction and the area okay. in which you're engaging in such an act. But I would say that, I think that we do have reason to be upset with people who walk around all the time wearing these things, especially if it's happening in a professional or a, romantic setting. You know, after we published this story, there were plenty of people who were tweeting their own experiences about life living with people who are wearing AirPods. And it really is amazing. I mean, you talk about, like, there are people in hospitals, like nurses, who walk in with AirPods in their ears. I mean, this is crazy, the fact that we're allowing this technology to so intrude in our life this way is pretty interesting to me, I think.
Mine always fall on my ears, so I don't have this. I can't walk around. I sometimes wear them at my desk, but I have this hair that hides them, so nobody knows. So, you could try that maybe if you wanted to.
That's true. I'm going to grow my hair out.
Okay, good. Good.
Looks a little different.
So how is it different than someone just using their phone? Last week, we talked about phone fubbing. I don't know if you've heard that term, but just like when you're with someone and you're using your phone. How is this different than that?
Yeah, I think it's actually less rude than using your phone in person. I think that's about, if I'm trying to talk to you and you're using your phone while you're talking to me, that's like super off-putting. But I do think that this is something that has the potential to be more common. I'm not always holding my phone, but I could always be wearing AirPods. So it's like, this is just a new thing that we're going to have to deal with in society. And this is just the beginning. I mean, we had a professor quoted talking about brain chips that are going to get implanted within a certain number of years, which I think is a pretty spot on prediction. And then we're going to really have this situation where we're not going to know whether people are paying attention to us or the digital world that we're now surrounded with. And it brings up some new questions for society.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's not necessarily new because I think it's been a long time where people were wearing those like Plantronic things around their ears. And like, you know, you get into an elevator and they would be someone would be like, hey, how are you? And I would I am doing great. And then they'll be like, oh, I'm talking on the phone, not talking to you. So it's not exactly new, yeah. but it seems more widespread.
That's right. Also, when you think about those Bluetooth things, people wearing those Bluetooth devices in their ears were generally thought of as jerks. Or just people completely socially unaware. Mm-hmm. I think what's changed is that AirPods are now a status symbol. People are wearing them all the time and it's become a fashion accessory. And what happens when a fashion accessory puts a barrier between people in the real world and people in the digital world, or at least that seem to be living in it. Mm-hmm. So I think that not exactly a totally new phenomenon, but we never really had a mass situation like we really seem to be heading toward with AirPods. Mm-hmm.
So I know people always say like everyone should be a waiter in their life. I have never been a waiter. So I say everyone should work retail in their life because that was one of my first jobs. And I think we can both agree that using AirPods, I mean, maybe just even if you're not listening to anything, maybe take them out before you approach the counter.
I 100% agree. Actually, this is something that that really got the story idea started in my head where I was like, coming back from a run, I wanted to get a coffee and I just left the AirPods in. And I just realized that what I had done was I wouldn't say terrible, but really the wrong thing to do. And it did feel like this, as the screenshot just showed, this really odd flex, even if it's unintentional. So from now on, whenever I'm in, I take them out. I want to be able to let people know that they have my attention. I have their attention 100%. And it's not like I'm listening to music or a podcast or anything while we're interacting. I just think it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. It was terrible, Alex. I'm here to say that was a terrible thing you did.
Well, I take full responsibility. My mea culpa is telling the internet, listen, we got to be considerate about what we're doing, in these situations. And hopefully, look, if even one person takes their AirPods out when interacting with the server because of this story, then I feel like my job has been done.
Yeah. So what... what other etiquette? Take them out. Is there any other etiquette? What about, I have a real question about the AirPods 2, where you can speak to Siri without, tapping anything. What's the etiquette there?
I would say that you got to use common sense. Like I would say, don't, you can, if you're speaking with somebody and a question comes up, don't just immediately launch into, hey, Siri, and then just kind of figure it out that way. Like, I would say, hey, is it all right if I ask Siri? Or, like, make it clear that you're about to engage with your device and take a look into the person's eyes and see if that's something that they want or not. And if it's something they don't want, I think it'll be pretty clear. And then you can just keep on going about your conversation. I don't think anybody's life has really been ruined by their inability to access Siri in the middle of a conversation. So I think people should keep that in mind before, calling her into any of these situations.
Right. I mean, and we also have this idea of the future where, like, these buds will say, that's Alex Kantrowitz. You know, you interviewed him once. Like, give you this information so you can be like, hey, Alex, great to see you. Is that something that you would want, like, little helpful hints in your ear?
I don't want it. I think that technology companies would be better left, keeping this stuff out of circulation. It's tough enough to, build normal relationships with people as it is. So if we're going to have technology continuing to chime in and, what if it got something wrong? You say, oh, sorry, my glasses told me that you were somebody else. It's just like, it's pretty strange. I think it's unnecessary. I think we have that kind of part figured out. And also, like, our ability to forget is an important thing that I think is really underrated. And the digital world takes that away in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So, more forgetting, I think, is probably better for humanity.
So what about, I've read that, we're nearing the end of when we'll need to really learn other languages just to communicate with other people. That there might be buds in our ear that, if you were speaking to me in French, it would just translate. Is that something, that you would like to see?
Yeah, I love that. I think that when you're in a situation where you can't communicate with somebody at all, being able to... have that conversation with the assistance of technology is a pretty amazing thing. And, if you're asking like whether it's better to be able to converse with someone kind of awkwardly through tech or just kind of, do hand signs and noises, try to have a conversation with them. I would say tech is like an inferior use case to like being able to communicate with someone naturally, but it really opens up like amazing doors. And, over the spring, I was taking a drive by myself in the south of Turkey. And the reason that I was able to do it was because I had Google Translate on my phone. So whenever I sat down with people, you know, we were able to have a conversation by putting phrases in and, you know, passing the phone back and forth and being able to converse. So if the headphones were able to make that happen, you know, I think that would be great. So as with all technology, this stuff isn't all bad. There's a lot of good uses to it. But I guess my main message is people should just be a little more cognizant of the signals they're sending when they have these things in.
I agree. Or just grow their hair long. That's another solution.
Yeah, I like that.
Okay, you have a newsletter. Tell us about what will we get in your newsletter?
Yeah, thanks for letting me promote a little bit. It's called the Tech Giant Update. And it is mostly analysis, news analysis about Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, and we're adding a fifth, Microsoft. And so each week will basically be an opportunity for me to empty my notebook out, let people know things that I'm seeing that aren't always turned into stories, but I think that can also be some color and maybe even a little more interesting than your typical news story. So I encourage everybody to subscribe. You can find it by just Googling Tech Giant Update. And I really want to have a two-way conversation with it. That's one of the things that I've thought about in terms of establishing this. So, I'll send the emails out. And the thing that I enjoy the most is hearing from people who read it and react to the ideas in there.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us. Alex Kantrowitz is a senior technology reporter at BuzzFeed. He can be found at Kantrowitz on Twitter. And go ahead and subscribe to his newsletter. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Take care.
Hey, bye.
And if you're listening to this right now with AirPods and you're walking up to buy something from someone, take those off. Thank you. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv. We love it if you would subscribe to our show. That way you get it right away. Go to twit.tv/tnw. And you can subscribe to the audio or the video, different versions, depending on how much space you have in your phone or where you listen. You can find it everywhere. And follow us on the social networks. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're everywhere. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroney. Jason Howell will be back next week, thank goodness. And thanks to our Alex, both Johns, especially the John who promises not to upload the unedited audio version of the show this week like he did last week. Those of you who got it, you know what I'm talking about. You're welcome. And, of course, thanks to Burke. And especially thanks to you for watching and subscribing to Tech News Weekly. We'll see you next week.
Yeah.